Hi everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. You're listening to episode 20 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Richard J. Poupard, who is a medical doctor and a board-certified oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Michigan. He also has an earned MA in Christian apologetics from Biola University and is a speaker for the Life Training Institute. In the 2016 volume 39, number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Rich has written an article for our Viewpoint column. Viewpoint addresses relevant contemporary issues in discernment and apologetics from a particular perspective that's usually not shared by all evangelicals. So we hope that readers' thinking on Viewpoint issues will be stimulated and enhanced, whether or not they end up agreeing with the author. Rich's Viewpoint article is called, Should We Continue to Use the Term Sexual Purity? Rich, it's good to have you on.
Well, thanks so much, Melanie. It's great to be here.
You know, several years ago, the Barna Institute did a survey, and they surveyed millennials and asked them why they were leaving the church. And the number four reason given was because they didn't feel like their questions on sexuality were ever answered in the context of the church, and they felt like the church was silent on that issue. So in light of that, when did the term sexual purity start coming up? Because I think it's affected that generation in particular. So those are kids between 18 and 35, and I think some of them on the older spectrum kind of grew up with that term sexual purity.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It certainly has affected them. And obviously, the Christian sexual ethic is not a new thing. God's plan for marriage and God's plan for sexual intimacy within marriage is nothing that we invented. However, in the early 1990s, in response to a lot of the changes that the evangelicals saw within culture, we saw culture being more sex-saturated, that the message of the world was increasingly that sexual experimentation and activity amongst our young people is virtually inevitable. And the only way or the best way to combat the consequences of such sexual behavior is simply using layers of thin latex and artificial hormones. And as a response to that, we started to kind of change or repackage the message of sexual abstinence. And in fact, we started to try to change what is essentially a negative message, a negative prohibition that you need to avoid all sexual activity, into a positive choice. And we called that choice focusing on sexual purity. And it involved a lot of different things. But one of the things, instead of saying that, you know, that we had to avoid something, we're able to make a choice, and that choice was to remain sexually pure and to attempt to empower us and to also kind of have peer groups that would give pressure to not, instead of to having sex early, to remaining, quote-unquote, sexually pure until marriage.
So if sexual purity is used essentially synonymous with abstinence, in other words, you don't literally you have intercourse before marriage, you are quote-unquote a virgin, does that mean that it's God's will for an unmarried person to remain abstinent prior to marriage? And I would say also, you know, if somebody was celibate, in other words, they were single for their whole life.
In a word, absolutely. The Christian sexual ethic has not changed. And in my article, I don't want to imply that somehow we need to liberalize what God has clearly stated. I believe God's moral will is very clear in terms of human sexuality, that the gift of sexual intimacy is designed to be enjoyed and experienced only during a covenantal marriage. And that also means, of course, that sexual abstinence before marriage and sexual fidelity within the bounds of a marriage. And that message, that certainly that standard has not changed.
So what are some of the illustrations that have been used improperly to communicate the concept of sexual purity or abstinence to young Christians?
Yeah, because I read a number of testimonies in preparation to writing this article, and I was kind of fascinated that it's always these word pictures that stay with us. That is, of course, the reason why we use word pictures. But many, both young men and women who went through sexual purity culture, this is what stuck really with them. And oftentimes we'd use these word pictures. For instance, you'd use a piece of tape that lost the stickiness. The speaker would give a brand new piece of tape, and everybody would touch the sticky part, and by the time it got back to the front, it would no longer be sticky. A cardboard heart that was sawed into pieces that whenever you gave yourself to somebody, either physically or emotionally, you gave them a piece of your heart that you could never get back, and the heart could never go back to its original shape. A bruised and partially eaten apple. Obviously, if the grout takes a piece of the apple, then you can never put it back. And one that was frequently mentioned is a piece of used chewing gum. You give somebody a brand new piece of gum in its wrapper, they might be excited to eat it. But, of course, a piece of that's already been chewed by someone else, we would simply reject. We want to make sure we just don't get it on our shoes. And a result of that is that, you know, we're using these images that mean our value is dirty, defiled, and unclean objects. And those are the objects that are used to define our worth. And that is almost by definition objectifying human beings. Another problem with these word pictures, too, is that we either imply that something is either completely pure or completely impure, with really no in-between, which I don't think is an adequate picture, certainly for our purity in Christ's eyes.
I know in some of these illustrations that you have that if somebody did not measure up to them, it would produce what's called a core disgust reaction. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, this comes from psychologist Paul Rosen. This is pretty fascinating to me. He does this experiment in front of a group of people where he has a pitcher full of tap water, and he pours some of the tap water into a glass. He offers it to the front row, and they certainly drink it. Well, he takes the pitcher, and he puts a cockroach in the pitcher. And after he flails around in there for a while, he takes it out. And, of course, when he pours the glass, nobody offers to drink it. He then takes that same water that the cockroach was in, the impure water, and he passes it through a series of really, really strong filters. And at the end result, the water that comes out of the filter is actually far more pure than the tap water that he initially offered. And he offers that glass of water to the audience, and nobody accepts it. Even though that we can intellectually realize that that water is pure, there still is that disgust reaction. We saw that cockroach in there, so we still view it as impure. And that's a problem with these types of word images and some of the teachings on sexual purity. We will see, once we view something as impure, we see that impurity is eternal. It does not change. And it's tragic when viewing others, when you see someone else that you view as impure. And regardless of the fact of what Christ has done in their heart, you can't change that view. But I think it's even worse when we have that view ourselves. We view ourselves as impure, and there's nothing that we can do, even if intellectually we understand the forgiveness and grace of Jesus Christ, to really view ourselves as pure again.
So I would think that, I guess some people out there are probably thinking, like, what about the person who unfortunately was a victim of sexual abuse? Maybe it's something that their parent doesn't even know about, and then they're taken to one of these purity conferences or something like that. So how do some of these teachings impact that person? Because I know they are thinking in their mind that they are feeling very impure, and it's something that they did not seek out for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real tragedy. Obviously, the idea of somebody being sexually abused or suffering from abuse at an early age is tragic and evil amongst itself. And I was surprised at the number of individuals. It's far greater than I think we ever knew. Some studies have shown as much as one in four women and one in six men will suffer some form of sexual abuse in their lifetime. And as a consequence of sexual abuse, victims already feel just tremendous guilt and shame for what's happened to them. And that's just part of the normal healing process. It takes years of hard work in order to overcome those feelings of guilt and shame. And obviously you can see if you are comparing human beings to these defiled pictures, how bad that can be. We have an example, too. Elizabeth Smart was taken at a young age, a horrific, horrific story. And now she speaks openly on the forums for human trafficking. And this is a quote that she said when she was in captivity. She thought, "Oh, my gosh, now I'm that chewed up piece of gum. And nobody rechews a piece of gum. You just throw it away." And that's how easy it is to feel like you no longer have worth, you no longer have value. And in her biography, she stated that those feelings of unworthiness and that she no longer had value because of something that she didn't have control over, something that was done to her that made her lose her purity. It was one of the reasons why she didn't try harder to escape. So I think that we have to be very cognizant of showing love and compassion and empathy towards those who've been in just a horrific situation. And the last thing that we want to do is heap further shame and further difficulties on them.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Richard J. Poupard, who has written a viewpoint article for our Volume 39, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal called Should We Continue to Use the Term Sexual Purity? To read his opinion piece, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. Rich, we were just talking about just the impact of this kind of thinking, especially on people who have suffered sexual abuse. So what's wrong with the term or the phrase that we use? I think it's almost become a cliche, really, in evangelicalism about, quote, remaining sexually pure until marriage, unquote.
Yeah, well, so far we've talked about the impact of the sexual purity teachings and the term sexual purity on those that are not married. But I do think that we have to look at also the impact that it's had on those that have been married. And if you use the term you're allowed to remain sexually pure until marriage, I guess the question is that what happens then? What happens when, how is sexuality viewed within a covenant marriage if you've had to, you know, avoid sexual activity in order to remain sexually pure? Oftentimes, couples have said that once they become married, they feel like sex is now, it's still an impurity, but it's something that God allows. It's some kind of allowable impurity that God tolerates, and that's the sexual intimate life we have with our spouses. And a lot of couples have a really difficult time after viewing sexuality as something so bad and so that they had to avoid so hard in order to remain pure. Difficulty in flipping the switch into now it's something that is celebrated and encouraged within marriage, and that's something that's just not easy to do sometimes. And once again, if we use these word pictures, that certainly once you have sex with your husband or your wife, that you're still a piece of chewing gum that has been chewed, but thankfully only your spouse gets to chew it, and that's just not a good way to really view how wonderful the gift of sexual intimacy is within marriage as God's gift to us.
So if this sexual purity teaching can give false expectations about sexual intimacy within marriage, how should parents or youth leaders or church staff communicate clearly a better teaching about sexuality within marriage?
Yeah, well, one of the problems with the sexual purity teachings also is that oftentimes we're giving young people this message that as long as you remain sexually pure, as long as you avoid sexual activity before marriage, and especially if you don't allow yourself to become emotionally involved with anybody, that you are going to be promised an earth-shattering marriage with very little problems and just a fantastic intimate life within your marriage. As long as you wait until your marriage to have sexual activity, that it's almost like you're promised it's going to be great, and all you have to do, is remain pure, and then your sexual life with your husband or wife is going to be fantastic. And that's not necessarily true. In fact, oftentimes the vulnerability and the intimacy that you need to have in order to have a very good sexually intimate life with your spouse takes hard work and takes some time to accomplish. I think that what we need to do is we need to, before couples are married, to focus on preparing and strengthening couples for the real life, the real world challenges they face. As someone has been promised throughout their entire single life that all they have to do is remain sexually pure, then they are going to found the spouse, that everything is going to work out fantastic, God is going to bless every aspect of their marriage, and then they have difficulties. It brings in a lot of challenges, and you know, is God, did he tell me the truth? Was I being told the honest thing in terms of what was to be expected in marriage. And I don't think that's a wise way to approach the challenges that many couples have in the early days of their marriage.
So I know along with the sexual purity movement, there's also been the mention of the term emotional purity. In other words, that we need to guard our hearts because it's the wellspring of life. That's what it says in Proverbs 4:23. How should we look at that for our young people, especially also on the flip side of that, protecting them or allowing them to understand what it's like to have inappropriate emotional attachments, which I wonder these days if it's easier for kids to have with all the texting and social media and all of this kind of thing where they're casually kind of revealing a ton about their inner emotional life to a lot of people online.
Yeah, that's a great question, especially in today's world. This is a topic that's really difficult to navigate and always has been. But I think one of the emotional purity teaching as an offspring of the sexual purity is a misreading of Proverbs 4, that in the ancient world, the idea of guarding our heart was not merely, the heart was not seen as a mere the emotional center of our existence. The idea of the heart was pretty much almost equivalent to our soul. It's both our mind and our hearts and our emotions and our thoughts and all of that things all together. And what Proverbs 4 is saying is basically that we should be wise. We should seek wisdom of others, and we should allow that. Not necessarily that we should not allow us to be emotionally vulnerable with another human, with other human beings. And I know we have to teach care here, but, you know, teaching that we should not allow ourselves to be vulnerable at all to another person until right before our wedding. And then, once again, we flip the switch, then we can be all in terms of emotional vulnerability. I don't think it's necessarily a wise thing and a best thing to teach our young people. That, in fact, vulnerability, emotional vulnerability, is a precursor for biblical love. And the fear of that vulnerability and connection is not necessarily a characteristic of a virtuous person. But the other point also exists on the other end of the spectrum, in which we can be in a situation, either marriage, in which we are keeping our fidelity physically, but we are allowing ourselves to be emotionally involved with someone in an inappropriate manner, or teaching our kids, especially right in the age of social media, where everything is out there to lay everything out. Both of those viewpoints is just too far in the extreme. And how we exactly negotiate whom we allow ourselves to become at least slightly emotionally vulnerable, I think is a lifelong learning and not necessarily something that we can sum up very quickly. But at the same time, I do think that we have to be careful that we just teach our kids that the best way for them to negotiate and to navigate these very, very difficult waters is simply to clam ourselves up and not allow ourselves to be vulnerable at all.
So how does a wrong view of sexual purity affect our relationship with Christ? It seems to me that in this view, there's not room for understanding truly that we are sinners, because I would think that we all have, according to the Bible, you know, all of us are sinners, and that none of us have true sexual purity at all, even before our marriage. So if we have this false impression that as long as we haven't done certain physical things or certain emotional things that we are pure, how does that affect, one, our relationship with Christ, and two, our view of sin?
Yeah, it's very, very, I think this is one of the most important aspects of sexual purity teaching and some of the inadvertent messages that it may have come across. If we're not careful, we can easily communicate this idea that our purity is based somehow on our behavior, either the positive things that we do or the things that we have avoided. And that's very damaging. The idea that we think we can go before God in a pure state because we've avoided certain things, I think is simply almost antithetical to the gospel message. Secondly, we have to be very careful in terms of how we view young people who have made the sin of engaging in sexual activity prior to marriage. When we equate that to purity, How do we somehow deal with the young teen that may have not had intercourse with his boyfriend, with their boyfriend or girlfriend, but have viewed hundreds and even sometimes thousands of hours of pornographic images, have been dehumanizing, objectifying human beings for all that period of time? And yet we can act like they're sexually pure, whereas a teen who made a poor choice one night, one time, is now considered sexually impure. And will now suffer consequences that cannot be undone. That some sins are seen as just completely beyond grace. Once you're made impure by these ways, that you're almost permanently defiled. And we can give lip service to the fact that Christ can forgive us and make us pure again, but the images are still there, that you've lost something that you can never, ever, ever get back. We have to understand that it's only the grace and forgiveness of Jesus Christ that makes us pure. Certainly not our behavior, that we have all failed in this manner. We were born sinners, and certainly none of us comes with a pure heart in terms of our sexuality. So understanding our need and Christ's desire to make us pure in his eyes because of his sacrifice is a very important message that can be lost if we're not careful.
It seems like you were just saying, that the sexual purity movement really has, you know, come down to things that are prescriptive, don't do these things, so, and less gospel-centered. And so what should be the goal instead of Christian sexual education? How should, again, Christian leaders, parents, and youth workers approach this subject that's not prescriptive but more gospel-centered?
Sure. One of the first important things is try to, this is always a difficult topic to talk about, but to kind of allay the fear of what information is. You know, talking to kids about sexual intimacy, talking to kids about what is the goal of sexual intimacy and God's plan for us, to remove some of that fear, to be open about it, I think is a very important aspect. I think there's some fears that if we, you know, allow that information to get out too soon, that it's going to be encouraging to do poor behavior, and I don't think there's any evidence of that. The ability to express the Christian sexual ethic in a true and loving manner, to explain that, yes, this is what God wants for our lives, but there is also forgiveness for those who have failed. And, you know, this is the way to look forward to what you are going to experience in a marriage, and to learn to prepare all the couples for the experiences and the challenges that they're going to encounter during marriage. We almost go in the other direction. Our culture views sexuality as, you know, makes too much of a deal about it in our world, where we don't want to make the same mistake of placing it on such a high altar and thinking it's going to be so fulfilling once we're married, as a means to avoid it when we're not married. Be very, very careful with that, because a lot of couples struggle with their sexual intimate lives after their marriage. And I think most importantly, too, just learn to express God's grace and forgiveness for everyone who has failed in the area of sexual sin. And not just those who have failed physically in that area, but for each and every one of us. None of us approaches sexuality with a completely pure heart. And all of us need God's grace for the thoughts that we've had, for our ideas that we have prior to marriage. And to understand fully what God's gift of sexual intimacy is requires us to be very, very careful that we don't give kids the wrong message. We don't want to gloss over the gospel message of grace and forgiveness in order to change their behavior.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun, rapid-fire questions for Rich. Well, fall is upon us, so Rich, do you drink pumpkin spice lattes?
I haven't this year, but I must admit, I'm not proud of it, but I certainly have in the past.
What is one of your favorite hobbies?
Right now, it's pretty much playing board games with my kids.
Do you do your own taxes?
No, I do not do my own taxes.
Do you play an instrument?
I used to. I played trumpet in high school, but now I pretty much listen to my kids practicing their violin and drums.
And if you could travel back in time, where would you go?
Oh, man. You know, since I only know this lifetime, I think I would travel back. It's kind of a little boring. I like having antibiotics and medical care, so I don't think I'd go back very much. But there are probably some mistakes I'd make as a youth that I might want to revisit. So probably just back to the 1967 when I was born.
Well, thanks, Rich, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities Podcast.
Thank you so much, Melanie. I appreciate it.
Rich has a viewpoint article in Volume 39, Number 5 of the Christian Research Journal called Should We Continue to Use the Term Sexual Purity? To read his article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure you also go to equip.org, where you can download our free smartphone app on which you can listen to the Bible Answer Man broadcast live, listen to previous broadcasts, make a donation, and subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. So until our next author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast.